It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Show where we're balancing the intellectual with the creative, with the idea of exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. And for the topic hour, we do that by going out and about, talking to people on the street about lots of different topics that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are such an important way that we engage with the world. This week, I'm featuring my interview with Laurie R. King. Laurie has a new book out, which I'm currently reading. It's called Lockdown and is an intricate, character-driven, psychological suspense novel. The Washington Post Book World says Laurie has amazing range as a writer, and her new book, Lockdown, is described as tense, poignant, brilliantly paced. The story features Principal Linda McDonald, who arrived a year previously at Guadalupe Middle School, determined to overturn the school's reputation for truancy, gang violence and neglect. One of her initiatives is Career Day, bringing together children, teachers and community presenters in a celebration of the future. But there are some in attendance who reject McDonald's bright vision, and no one at the gathering anticipates the shocking turn of events that will transform a day of possibilities into an explosive confrontation. Lockdown charts compelling characters on a collision course, a chain of interactions that locks together a community's hidden lives, troubling secrets and the bravest impulses of the human heart. I am just at the beginning of the book, but I'm really enjoying it so far, and it's already, I can feel the tension building. Well, Laurie came into the studio and we talked about her childhood, why she started writing, what books and being a writer mean to her, and her long career. Laurie has over 3 million books in print, which is a sign of her remarkable popularity as a writer. So let's hear some of our conversation. I'm very happy to have in the studio with me now Laurie R. King, award-winning, internationally best-selling author of over 25 books, including the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, Kate Martinelli books, and novels, including The Bones of Paris. And King started writing in 1987 when her second child entered school and had her first novel published in 1993. And since her first book, A Grave Talent, which won the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award for Best First Novel and the Creasy Award from the UK Crime Writers Association, she's averaged a book a year, gathering multiple nominations for and winning many prestigious writing awards, including The Beekeeper's Apprentice being chosen as one of the top 100 favorite mysteries of the 20th century. A third-generation Northern Californian who has lived most of her life in the San Francisco Bay Area, Laurie R. King has also spent a considerable amount of time in Britain, reflected in her characters spending time in both these areas. Her background is as mixed as any writer's, from degrees in theology and managing a coffee store to raising children, vegetables, and apparently the occasional building. So I'm not sure what that means. Maybe we can ask her about that. The Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series allows King to explore all sorts of ideas, the roots of conflict in the Middle East and Afghanistan, feminism and early Christianity, patriotism and individual responsibility, whilst also having a rousing good time with revisiting the scenes of The Hound of the Baskervilles and Kim, setting a pair of Bedouin nomads down in a grand country house in England and forging an unlikely relationship between two remarkably similar individuals who happen to be separated by age, sex, and background. The five Kate Martinelli books feature a modern homicide detective based in San Francisco, and the latest book, The Art of Detection, brings about a meeting of the Mary Russell and Kate Martinelli worlds. Laurie has also written standalone novels and nonfiction in what can only be described as a remarkable career. Welcome to the studio, Laurie.
Thank you, Ruth.
So for the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with your career, I'm wondering if you could tell us how you came to start writing.
Oh, I was one of those writers who got started because they loved reading. And you know how it is, you go to the library one time and you just can't find anything that appeals. And so you think, well, if I sit down and write a story, maybe I could keep myself busy longer than just a book would take.
Right. I read something in your autobiography which is fascinating about the fact that you had a fairly peripatetic existence as a child, and that was one of the reasons that you liked libraries so much. It was a sort of way of finding community.
Yeah, we moved a lot. I'm trying to think. I don't know that there were any 2 years when I was actually in the same school in September that I had been in June.
Wow.
And so, as you say, it's really home to think of a library, because it's instead of having to make new friends and having to face yet another new classroom of people, it's the same familiar faces and friends and titles. And
yeah. Well, I think this is where the appeal of reading comes from for so many people, in that you can make friends with books in a way that you can't if you're seeing a film or something like that, because you disappear into the world of the book. You just can feel that those are your friends, you know, that, in, I mean, obviously not like real people, but in your imagination.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I think that I found myself living in that. I was a great fan of the, did you ever read the Walter Farley Horse, the Black Stallion, and all the rest of them?
No, I didn't.
They were great American classics. And there was a period when I was a child where, you know, I kind of think, in fact, I had a laugh at the idea that that I qualify for the title of your session here, which is balanced. Because yeah, I'm honored to be thought balanced, but when I was a kid, I probably should have been in severe therapy, because I spend an awful lot of my time with packages of that plasticine clay, making little horses and telling myself stories about the horses and their lives. So, you know, not really the most balanced individual, but I think it's very true that stories like that inhabit your life.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you say maybe not the most balanced individual, but, you know, you look today at how a lot of children are spending their time, and I think, you know, spending a bit more time with little plasticine figures and creating worlds and using your imagination might not be a bad thing.
It's true. It's true. I don't think it was altogether a bad thing, but it was just odd.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me you found the best way of coping. It was a coping mechanism that has led you into storytelling on a much greater scale, hasn't it? So,
sure.
Yeah. Sure. You'll take that one.
Yeah. I haven't started writing horse books, so.
So, speaking with new writers in mind, you've said that they should remember, you are a writer, not the author of a book. Keep that in mind. And that really spoke to me, but I wondered, what does it mean to you to be a writer?
I think the point that I was trying to make with that statement is an awful lot of writers who will do one book and then get so involved in either selling it to a traditional publishing house, or now that everyone's putting stuff online, getting entirely wrapped up in the business of selling an ebook online, of promoting it, of packaging it, of interacting with potential readers. And it just seems to me that that's pretty much self-destructive when it comes to a writing career. Because if you have all of your attention focused on that peripheral stuff of packaging the book and yourself, you are not writing. And ideally, you would like to do nothing but write.
Mm.
There's other things that do rear their heads, especially as you go along in this career. But the way that you become a full-time writer is to write.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I think a lot of the people who go down the e-book route feel that perhaps there isn't another route. I mean, with the way, you know, book selling is going and everything, do you still feel that it is possible to follow the traditional route? I mean, obviously some people still are, but is it realistic to think, okay, I'm going to try and get an agent, I'm going to then get a, you know, proper publishing contract?
Well, yeah. I think that I tend to be very leery of e-books as a career, simply because it's really tough to run yourself as a publishing house. And I am one of those writers who depends very heavily on an editor.
Mm.
My editor is my primary reader. She's not always right, but anytime she objects to something, it tells me that I need to spend some attention on whether it's a plot or whether it's some kind of pacing problem or whatever it is that she as an editor is looking at. It is very difficult to do that yourself.
Mm.
There are probably a few people out there who can edit themselves, but there are an awful lot who think they can edit themselves.
Yes.
And to find a freelance editor who can take your book and polish it is very dicey.
Mm.
So that basically what it boils down to is if you're writing and you're finding your own editor and your own copy editor and you are finding someone who can design a cover and you are doing a marketing plan, I mean, isn't it better to turn that machinery over to a company that does it and
yeah.
that knows what they're doing? I mean, there are drawbacks in traditional publishing, sure. You have less control, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
There are people who write the kinds of things that publishing just doesn't recognize what to do with.
Yes, yeah.
And you may be one of those.
I think I had another author on, Michael Marshall Smith, and he was saying, you know, that there's, which is what I hear you saying, really, there's a reason in a publishing house that there's all these different disciplines, you know, there's all these different people involved in producing a book. So it's kind of unrealistic to just think you will have all the talents to the level needed to produce an equivalent product. And so at the very least, you should be drawing on getting people from outside. But as you say, it's very hard to know what the standard of what they're doing is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if you are turning that all over to a publishing house, that means that you are writing, period.
Yeah. I think that's a big issue for artists. And I know the way the music industry has gone, it's become a huge thing of like, it's, you know, record companies now don't do the artist development anymore. You're expected to develop yourself and, you know, have a following on the internet and all these things. And like you say, it leaves very little time for the art. It's a bad model, I believe. So I'm with you on that. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland and my guest this hour, Laurie R. King. Do join us after the break.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain. Did I or didn't
It's a question of balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with guest, best-selling, internationally best-selling author, Laurie R. King. And Laurie is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz, who we heard from in the break, on June 13th at 7 p.m. to talk about her new psychological suspense thriller, Lockdown. As I mentioned at the beginning, I'm currently reading it. It's already incredibly suspenseful, and I'm not that far in. She's a wonderful writer, and this Bookshop Santa Cruz event, it's a great chance to meet in person one of the best loved mystery crime writers in America. So I encourage you to go along to that. That's Bookshop Santa Cruz, June 13th at 7 p.m. Laurie will be talking about her new book, Lockdown, signing books, answering questions. So Laurie came into the studio and spoke to me. We're hearing that conversation, so let's hear some more of that now. I've got Laurie R. King in the studio with me, internationally best-selling author of the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, Kate Martinelli books, and novels including The Bones of Paris. And I wanted to send you to her website, Laurie R. King, and that's LaurieRKing.com. It really is just a treasure trove of information about all her books and characters, and it's just wonderfully comprehensive. So you'll really enjoy going there, whether you've read her books or not. I would really suggest it. So, Laurie, I was wondering, do you find genre pigeonholing at all? You know, this idea of being referred to as a mystery writer rather than just a good writer.
I think a lot of crime writers do complain about that. I have never felt uncomfortable being classified as a genre writer. I mean, for one thing, if you look at genre writers as compared with mainstream writers, you probably would find we tend to make a living off of it better. People like genre. People like crime.
Yeah.
It is a lovely combination, both, I'm speaking as a writer and a reader, a combination of interesting distraction and mental challenge. And I love the way you can slip in all kinds of strange bits and pieces in a crime novel. Because you're dealing with issues that matter, with life and death, literally issues.
Yeah.
You also feel comfortable with the kinds of issues that that spill over, so that the state of politics in Southeast Asia, the crimes against young officers and gentlemen in the First World War by their
superiors.
Yeah. All those sorts of things. In a mainstream novel are very tricky to fit in, but in a crime novel they're necessary because they add the kind of weight you need. Mm. And they make it a satisfying read and a satisfying way of telling a story.
Yeah. I was wondering if you think, the sort of mysteries are so popular, whether the fact that mysteries get solved is comforting in a way. You know, there's so many things in our own lives that don't work out, that just sort of reading something where there's problems and everything gets explained and tied together and it comes together, whether on a psychological level, whether that appeals.
Oh, I think that's one of the big reasons people like crime novels, is that they do have an end. I mean, any other novel you can just trail off anywhere, and you know it's about a marriage or it's about travel and you don't have a problem that needs a solution. But with a crime novel, you must have an ending. Every so often, you'll find a crime novel that tries to sort of get literary and having ambiguity at the end. I don't have any time for that. That's cheating. But the crime novel basically is a quest. It is a quest not only for the truth of who done it and why, but it's also a kind of quest that works on the investigator and the people who are tasked with finding out the truth.
Yeah.
And as a quest, you have to get somewhere in order to achieve what your goal is. So.
Yeah. And I know you wrote your thesis on the role of the fool in Western culture. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you like to work with archetypes in your fiction, whether you do that consciously or whether it just sort of weaves in.
Archetypes like Sherlock Holmes. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, I am often conscious of, not necessarily as I am writing a first draft, because I am a very undeliberate kind of writer, but quite often when I'm going through that and working on and making the story actually tell what I would like it to tell, which to my mind is the trickier part of it.
Right.
But during the rewrite, I will often be aware that characters are interacting on a that kind of archetypal level.
Yeah.
That you have a hero who needs to fill a certain role in the story.
Yeah.
The book I'm working on at the moment, I've just realized that one of my characters is indeed a fool. Suddenly try and flesh out that side of his character is going to make the rewrite really fun.
Yeah.
For me.
That's interesting. So you're focusing first on the sort of plot, in a way, of how the story works through. Well, I know you yes. don't. I know you don't plot in advance, but you're in the no. first draft. You're going through, and you're like, "Oh, good, I've got a story." And then you might go deeper with the nuances and things. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Yeah. My first draft is really a kind of 300-page outline. It's the mechanics. It gets me from beginning to end, and all the pieces kind of mesh.
Right.
But it's not a novel.
Okay.
And it's the rewrite is when I turn that piece of machinery of characters, plot, and setting into a satisfying read and
right.
something that has depth to it.
Yeah.
The rewrite is where I put most of my interest. I mean, it's fun. The first draft
yeah.
is fun. Most of the time, sometimes it's a pain, but the real interesting part is the deepening the characters and really working on how they interact and how they really explore the themes of the novel, which I never know what it is until I finish. I say, "Oh, that's what this book is about."
That's interesting. And obviously, the different series that you have and the standalone novels, they're quite different from each other. And is your process the same for all of them in the terms of you just kind of write, you don't plot in advance?
Not so much. Depends on the kind of book. The Russells are much more organic. And because they're first person, they're you know, she reflects as she goes. Some of the other books are, I have in fact done a lot more outlining in the sense of this needs to happen, then this needs to happen, and then I can go there. And I need to see how the machinery is turning before I can really write, because there's so many complex bits that need to go into that chapter or that section. And in fact, The Bones of Paris was one that I did actually do a lot of that pre-work.
Right.
I don't know. Outline doesn't seem like quite the right term for it, but to sequence the plot in my mind.
I was going to ask you about The Bones of Paris. Publishers Weekly described it as impressive, arresting, a tantalizing mystery. A reader review on Amazon states, "I was surprised and disturbed, yet could not look away. The rich and eerie descriptions were as revolting as they were compelling, sending shivers down my spine. It is a no-holds-barred exploration of some of the strangest artistic minds of the time. This is not a book for the faint of heart. Despite the relentlessly macabre displays that take up so much of this novel, I did enjoy it a great deal." And I was wondering what draws you to delve into such darkness, and I guess why you think people like to read about it.
Well, yes, it's one of those things that because so many people know me through the Mary Russell books, which are they're not cozies in the sense that they're whodunits, but they're very much not R-rated, shall we say?
Right. Yeah.
And it's. There are certain kinds of stories that you cannot tell in that setting, in that slightly whimsical milieu of as a 15-year-old girl who meets Sherlock Holmes and becomes his apprentice. And you say, oh, right, sure. And although you can play it straight to a certain degree, there are certain kinds of stories you can't tell. And every so often, I will have one of those that is itching away at me, and we'll talk to my editor and say, I want to do this. And The Bones of Paris is one of those.
So where is your motivation in telling stories that do you delve into such sort of darkness in human nature and perversion and horror? Well, I mean, it's not a rhetorical question. I mean, it's like, you know, obviously there's a whole genre of dark fiction and people like to read about it. And why do you think that is?
There's a lot of those kinds of stories that I have problems with. There are a lot of them that I get the feeling as I'm writing through, as I'm reading through them, that the writer is getting too much pleasure in torturing women. Mm. And at that point, I begin to draw back, because I think that there's probably a place for that in the world, but it's not in my life.
All right, yeah.
On the other hand, there are dark... Sometimes you have a story that requires dark shadows in order to bring the other stuff to light.
Mm.
And there's such a golden aura over Paris in the 20s that it seemed to me that in order to write about that, you have to have sufficiently black shadows at the same time, because the two have to go together.
Mm. Kind of like a yin-yang type of thing.
I didn't think I could be doing the story justice by not having the sort of horror, the grand guignol side of things, because that's what Paris was, for one thing. Hmm. And Paris was this fascinating mix of, you know, the city of light that yet had this
classical sort of community that sprang up around the Grand Guignol horrors. Mm. And it was a part of life for an awful lot of people there. Mm. And I just, that dichotomy just fascinated me.
Mm. Is it important to you to kind of show the light sort of being more prominent than the darkness, or not necessarily?
Oh, I think that in all my books you can tell I'm very much an optimist. I mean, I don't think I've written any books that that are really downers at the end. There was one book, in fact, it was the predecessor to Bones of Paris, which is a book called Touchstone.
Right.
And in my first draft, I must have been working out issues because I basically killed everyone off. I mean, just kind of killed them all and blow them all away.
Yeah.
And then as I was doing the rewrite, it sort of occurred to me that, you know, I didn't need to actually kill off all the characters in order to get the effect I was aiming for.
And, right, yeah.
And so I sort of brushed a few of them off and said, okay, you can just kind of bleed a little and you'll be fine. So it's really, I mean, it is terribly satisfying to, you know, to commit mass mayhem on fictional characters.
That's true. It's that all-powerful thing. I think that's what a lot of people get out of video games, you know, of that sense of power. But
it also means that people don't, you know, look at you quite so easily, and they sort of, you get a little more glances on the side, like, is she really thinking?
Well, I'm glad to hear that, you know, most of your books have an uplifting end, or certainly not a negative end. I think that's... I've asked before in Bookshop Santa Cruz, I'm like, okay, I you know, I don't mind if a book's sad and has difficult parts, but, you know, I kind of want to feel like it's life-affirming by the end, and they're like, And, like, there's nothing they could suggest. So I was just like, really? Like, is everything just so depressing? You know? It's like, life is hard. I want to read something where something gets worked out, and I think that's why I was asking you about the mysteries. Like, I'm a big fan of Poirot, mm-hmm. and actually talking, about archetypes, you know, he's often referred to as like Papa, calls himself Papa Poirot. So you've got this sort of like older, wise figure. And I think the Sherlock Holmes figure to some degree in your novels, you know, takes up that archetypal role. That's
yeah. It's been fascinating to see the Holmes archetype branch out into the 21st century recently on media. The, you know, Sherlock and the CBS One Elementary. That, I mean, that is so typical of how an archetypal image grows, is that it finds a home and flowers in a different setting.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that interesting too. And your Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series is hugely successful. And Fred Erisman, in his paper, If Watson Were a Woman, says male-female relations, for all the changes taking place in society, are at the heart of the Mary Russell stories. And I was wondering what you would say is at the heart of the stories, if there is one thing.
Well, I started the Russell stories as a way of looking at, I mean, The Beekeeper's Apprentice is a coming-of-age story of an extraordinary young mind. Here's a young woman who is basically a young female 20th century Sherlock Holmes. And what would that mind look like? And especially what would it look like in reflection of the sort of original? And that's what I was doing with those first books. I thought at first that really I wasn't terribly interested in the character of Holmes. The first two or three books, you know, he's an interesting character, but I didn't find him that compelling as a character to develop in a story. Mm. But as I went on and realized that Conan Doyle sold him short by refusing to allow him to come past the Great War. I mean, Sherlock Holmes ends with the Great War, and there was no place for him in the changed Britain of the late teens and 20s. And I thought, you know, that really
as I said, sells him short, that I thought he was a much more flexible character than that. And so I started started really looking at him as a character that I could develop after about three or four books. And I found him, you know, they're now an interesting duo to me. They're not just interesting when they get together and snipe at each other, which seems to satisfy a lot of people. But as they both walk forward, that kind of interests me.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a commercial break now, but you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And I'm talking to Laurie R. King. And if you'd like to find out more about her books or any information about her, you can go to laurierking.com, LaurieRking.com. Join us after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito.
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with guest Laurie R. King. And just to remind you that Laurie is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on June the 13th at 7 p.m. to talk about her new psychological suspense thriller, Lockdown. Gosh, Lockdown. I'm going, so I hope to see you there. It's a really interesting book. It's a standalone book rather than one of her series. And she'll be talking about it, willing to answer questions and also sign books. So if you can make it, that'll be a really interesting thing to go to. So again, that's June 13th at 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. So just continuing with the conversation that Laurie had with me when she came into the studio, let's hear some more of that now. I was thinking the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series. Mary Russell completed her 12th memoir recently. What keeps driving her to record the exploits of herself and Holmes, do you think?
Well, you know, I received all those memoirs in a large trunk, and I haven't got to the bottom of the trunk yet. So until I do, I will continue to turn out Mary Russell's. Yeah, it's the sort of thing that sometimes you will talk to writers who have a clear idea of where they're going with a series. And they'll have a kind of overall arc in mind of 10 stories or 12 stories or however many. And then there's people like me who, you know, not only am I not organized enough to have that, but I think that the Russell stories are much more open-ended, that they kind of follow a certain meandering pattern, but there's a lot of it that I'm not really sure where she's going until she gets there.
Right, yeah. I read somewhere that you said that her character, particularly at the in the opening novel, is your sort of dream of how you might have been at that age, instead of very shy and...
Oh, I think that, yeah, I think that anyone, pretty much any young woman of you know, the age of 14 to 17, secretly would love to be Mary Russell. And one of the early reviews for the book pointed this out, that Russell is for all those people who read the Conan Doyle stories and get to the end and think, but he doesn't mean me.
Right. Yes.
And yeah. With Mary Russell, one of the really lovely parts of all of the books is when she manages to get the better of Sherlock Holmes, to outsmart him, outwit him, out whatever.
Yeah.
And those are, they're so much fun to write. And I guess they must be fun to read.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly seems so. I'm enjoying them, that's for sure. And there's quite a lot of feminist themes just running through the book because of what you're saying, just the idea that a woman, or even a young woman, could be equal to an iconic figure like Sherlock Holmes. And I was thinking, though, about, you know, we accept this idea of disparity in age in relationships when the man is older. Why do you think we have such a trouble with it when the woman is older, which doesn't happen very often because it's so sort of frowned upon? But, or do you think there's something inherent in the dynamic that it works better if the man's older? Or,
well, shall I be politically incorrect and say it's because you expect women to have more sense than marrying a young man? Have I managed to offend all of your listeners now?
Well, but by extension, then, are you saying that the young woman who marries the older man doesn't have any sense?
Probably, yeah. Having been one myself, yeah. No, I think that, this is a question that often comes up, because when you first meet Russell in Holmes, she's 15, and he's in his 50s. And it's for several years, it is strictly a teacher-student relationship. They are friends, they are partners, as it were, in crime. But there is nothing in the least bit romantic about anything between them. And so I think the tricky bit for me was to make that transition between student-teacher and something that opens up a deeper kind of partnership.
Right.
I think there were a lot of things that went on at the time in the 20s that made it a very realistic situation, because women of Russell's position and age had a limited number of young men to choose from, because so many young men were killed in the Great War, either killed or severely damaged, either physically or mentally. And so an awful lot of young women found that they had to move out of their, you know, marriageable pool of prospects.
Right.
But I think there's also the business of, if you have someone like Russell, who is considerably more mature, it takes a lot of adjustment to find a young man who is that kind of mind,
right?
I don't know exactly why it works in the books, because you sort of think,
Ew.
It's a big difference, isn't it? Is it 40? 40 years?
It's about that, yeah.
But at the same time, I suppose, if you think... I think there's, well, there's two things. I think there's something timeless about homes, and then there's also something about, you know, who people really are, their spirit. If you meet someone whose spirit is just speaking to yours and they happen to be in a body that's 40 years older, then, you know, is that relevant at that point?
Well, since my husband was 30 years older than I it sort of seemed not really that far a reach.
Yes, yeah, no, that's right. And I think, you know, my speculation on it is that women are less tied to the physical, so it's easier for them to see what's within, whereas, you know, for men perhaps it isn't, it's quite so easy, and that's why it doesn't go the other way so much. But occasionally it does, doesn't it? It seems to be more so these days.
Well, if I ever manage to write a book with Mary Russell in her 50s, we'll see what kind of young man she looks for.
Yeah, and then I guess there's the other side of it is that how women develop. I mean, the prepossession of Mary Russell at 15 is very believable. I don't know, I'm probably offending lots of people now by saying maybe that same prepossession might not be in a boy of 15. Would you agree with that, or do you think that's sexist in itself?
Well, yeah, except I think that, you know, she doesn't really grow into herself until she hits the 21 age.
Right, yeah.
And she thinks of herself as very mature at 15, but... In fact, I mean, it was interesting to write somebody like that who thinks of herself as being more grown up than she is.
Yes, yeah. It's very fun, the whole world surrounding Mary Russell, this idea of the preface of that you found the manuscripts, and it's sort of like taking this story outside the picture frame, as it were, and into real life. How did that come about? I mean, you've kept it going in various instances with fans and things like that, and some people obviously really believe it, it very literally.
Well, there's it is an offshoot of the Sherlockian idea, the game, that is to a member of the Sherlock Holmes community, in Baker Street irregulars or not, you begin with the assumption that Sherlock Holmes was a real person, that he lived, he probably still is alive because his obituaries never appeared in the Times of London, so therefore. And Arthur Conan Doyle was his literary agent.
Right.
He was Dr. Watson's literary agent. So that's where we sort of start the game. And I go off from there with Mary Russell. Therefore, you know, if Holmes is real, therefore Mary Russell is real. And I have a lot of fun with some of the books with this sort of metafiction going on, that she reflects how odd it is to be the wife of a fictional character.
Right.
And how she occasionally feels slightly fictional herself, which not the last book, but the one before, which is called Pirate King, I had an awful lot of fun with that, because it's all about movies and fiction and real pirates who are not and fake pirates who are. And you know, this whole idea of where is the story and where is the lie is underlies that whole book, but underlies the whole series of...
Yeah.
Of, you know, yes, these are definitely memoirs of Mary Russell. I only take responsibility for them because I was given them.
Right. Editing them. It's a great willing suspension of disbelief, I think, isn't it? It just adds another dimension to it.
A merry conceit.
There we go, yes. If you just joined us, I'm talking to Laurie R. King, and you can go to her website, laurierking.com. This is It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. So you have a formidable interaction with your fans through your website. We were talking about that in the break. It's very detailed. How do you manage to engage with them so thoroughly and write and have a life?
Well, you're assuming amazing. I have a life.
Okay,
I basically have no life, yeah. No, it is one of those areas that you have to try and balance. Like we were saying at the beginning, this business of you become a kind of social media nexus. And I think an awful lot of new writers try and do it all.
they try and do, you know, Facebook and Pinterest, and they try and do, you know, Tumblr. And I mean, you have to choose the areas that you feel comfortable with and that don't eat up your whole life.
Mm.
And I have sort of felt my way over the years into, I blog, I post on the blog, not often, maybe once a week or so. Sometimes I'll go for several weeks and not do anything and then feel guilty. And I'm fairly active on Facebook. But the others, I can't get interested in them.
Right,
so
yeah.
I figure, you know, if people want to find me, they can find me.
Yeah, no, they certainly can, and you can certainly find all her books, too. And
what I love is when you go to a thing like one of the crime conferences, mm. and you find a bunch of your readers there who actually are friends. I mean, they have a dinner together, they have a community that goes on, and I love the online communities that have come together around, mostly around the Mary Russell stories, but partly about me. I'm invited in.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think that's every aspiring writer's dream. So that's a lovely thing that you have, and very deserved. A wonderful career ongoing, and we look forward to new books that are coming out. Again, if you want to find out about Laurie, you can go to her website, laurierking.com. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and that was my conversation with special guest Laurie R. King when she came into the studio and talked to me. And just to remind you that she's going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on June 13th at 7 p.m. to talk about her new psychological suspense novel, Lockdown, which I'm currently reading. It's a great chance to meet one of the most popular crime writers in America and have your burning question answered and your book signed. And Lockdown is described by Booklist as a riveting story of suspense and tragedy out of the most seemingly mundane ingredients, kids and adults preparing for a day at school. The violence doesn't explode until we're well into the book, but the lead up to the explosion has the feel of a brewing storm. We know something is going to happen even if we don't know what it is. A fine thriller as timely as it is gripping. So that's Lockdown. You can hear all about it. Bookshop Santa Cruz, June 13th, 7 p.m. Hope you might go along. And if you enjoyed this interview, you can hear it again or tell your friends about it. You can send them to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. Itsaquestionofbalance.com. And you can hear the podcast there, see photographs, get information, and listen to it at your leisure. And on the homepage, there's tabs at the top, topics and guests. If you click on those, it'll bring up all the previous shows, all the wonderful guests that I've had, and the very interesting, thought-provoking topics that we've covered. I look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for joining me.